Hello, and welcome to Health Centers on the Front Lines, the podcast of the National Association of Community Health Centers. After a winter surge, the Omicron variant appears to be waning just as we are entering the third year since the WHO declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. In this episode, we're going to look at how staff at the nation's 1,400 community health centers are holding up and ways to support their mental and emotional health going forward. I'm Alex Walker, your host today, and I'd like to ask a favor of those of you listening. If you enjoy today's episode, please take a moment to rate the podcast and share the episode with your networks. Joining me for this discussion are two of my NAC colleagues, Dr. Jenny McLaurin and Dr. Grace Wong. They both serve as senior fellows for public health integration and innovation at NAC. Jenny McLaurin is a pediatrician with 30 years of experience caring for underserved families at the local, state, and national level, including as medical director of migrant and community health centers. Grace Wong is a family physician who worked for more than 30 years at health centers and public health departments in New York City and Seattle, most recently at International Community Health Services in Seattle. Grace and Jenny, thank you for being here today. The prevalence of stress and emotional exhaustion among healthcare workers is well known. What are some of the mental and emotional health issues and challenges that you're hearing about from community health center staff around the country?
Well, I'll start off on this one. I think a lot of what we're hearing is similar to what the general public experiences, because a lot of our health center staff are community members. And when we think of health center staff, we're not thinking just of doctors or nurses, but really of the whole care team and the supportive staff. So your typical problems of how do I manage work and home and this unpredictability of schedules and chaos and calling out sick and coming back and working extra shifts, all of that is, of course, part of what happens. But in addition to that, it's the understanding that we are part of the essential workforce. And as essential workers, we have a moral obligation, or at least an understanding among ourselves, that we will stay present until the last possible moment. And our health centers have stayed open through this whole thing. But they've done that with a lot of cost to the people that work there. So in addition to the typical things that we struggle with, some of the things that I've heard about are just the impact of having lots of extra shifts when either staff leave or staff are sick, or there's a new vaccine rollout and it needs to be done very quickly. And so there's extra clinic time scheduled. That's been really, really difficult. And also the sadness at seeing initially people got really sick and potentially a number of their patients die, but secondly, at the divisiveness in our society and being treated on the one hand as an essential worker and on the other hand is somebody who gets mocked for wearing a mask or for asking people to put on a mask or for asking people to get vaccinated. And that is a really big stress. I'll stop there. And Grace, I'm sure you have other things to add.
I think, Jenny, you painted a sad but true picture of what our colleagues are experiencing. I think just a couple other things I'll add. There's been media attention. And one article that comes to mind is one that was in the New York Times earlier this year. I think it was the beginning of January, where one of our colleagues in San Diego talked about what it's like when, you know, we serve in underserved communities, and finding herself needing to act in ways that were inconsistent with her values, and knowing that her patients weren't getting ready access to the life-saving COVID-19 therapeutics in the same manner and ease that other patients in other more resource communities were, and what it felt like for her to do that. I think the other thing that I just also add is, you know, one of the great things about our staff and our health centers is that they're from the communities that our patients are from, and that brings a level of understanding and empathy like no other. But that also means that they are bringing with them their lived experience, which we know in this pandemic in our communities of color has led to disproportionate burden of disease and those impacts. And I guess the last thing I'd like to add is, you know, when we're all subject to the sort of dilemmas and things that come with the misinformation that is rife out there. So even though what we do in the health center, we do based on the evidence and the science, when we go home, that isn't always what our family members and our neighbors are using to make their decisions. And that can also be very difficult.
Yeah, I echo that last one, Grace. I've experienced that myself and my own family. And a colleague used the term whiplash, that we've all been through a lot of whiplash, and it just keeps happening and happening and happening. And while some might say that happens to everybody, it's a different feeling, a different severity when it's your job to try to promote the health and safety of people in this pandemic. It has a different effect.
I can imagine. And when your daily work experience is being minimized or ignored by mm-hmm. people who believe that
or denied
attention or denied. Well, that leads me to, I think this might relate to a concept that the two of you have been talking about for maybe over a year now, making presentations to help health centers address moral injury and distress to strengthen their workplace culture. Can you talk about what that term moral injury means, where it comes from, and how it relates to what health center staff are experiencing?
Sure. Actually, at NAC, we've been talking about moral injury and moral distress for a number of years. Although Jenny and I have only been on the staff at NAC for the last 3 or 4 months. So the work on moral injury and moral distress comes from, in my own learning, the writing of a psychiatrist, Dr. Jonathan Shea, who at the VA had worked with a number of veterans of the Vietnam War. And the notion of moral injury is that it comes from an accumulation of moral distress, which can arise from experiencing things where one has to do something that isn't consistent with one's values, or, you know, in the case of the healthcare examples, we've been citing what we know to be best practices. And with that comes physical signs that we also see in the aftermath of trauma, where there's changes in mood, there can be difficulty with sleep, changes in appetite. And that's sort of the short answer of moral distress and moral injury.
Yeah, and I think you asked Alex in that about resilience, why we aren't using that word as much. And I don't like the word burnout either, because burnout implies a very individual effect, and it's about the individual and not the systemic issue. So to be burned out means that I myself don't have the capacity to handle all of this stress and this sort of chaos, but somebody with more resilience would be able to do it, and somebody stronger than I am. So I'm kind of weak in that sense, and that the way that gets portrayed. And there are issues of people being in the wrong fit for their job on the best day of their job, being in the wrong fit, and no, they shouldn't be in that particular position, and they could be burned out or not resilient, but that's not what we're talking about here. So, do we need to be resilient? Well, all of us have to be resilient, but if we use the word resilience, like the idea of the old-fashioned toy of the blow-up punching bag figure, where you just knock it down and it falls down and then it pops back up, and then you knock it down and it falls down and it pops back up. That would be the use of resilience here, and it would be wrong, because the thing causing the injury is an outside force, not an inside inadequacy. And it's an immoral outside force, and it needs to be acknowledged, named, reckoned with, and leadership needs to support its removal to the extent possible. And to some extent, maybe it's not all possible, and that is where we need resilience. But first, we need to acknowledge the moral injury.
I think that's really important to be clear about the language that we're using to help people understand and process what it is that they're feeling and facing going through this.
I agree that with Jenny, that we have a preference for the terms that we think more accurately describe what's going on. But to be honest, I will talk to anybody who wants to talk to me about the health of our health center workforce. So if the way you want to open the conversation is using words that might be different than mine, that's really okay. Because I think at the end of the day, what we want to do is have a common final pathway on health and well-being for our staff.
Yeah, I think we're in total agreement on that. It's just more of, can we help everybody reframe? Because there's different answers depending on your interpretation of words.
Well, the one term I wanted to delve into a little bit more is the idea of moral injury in, say, the health center setting, to the extent that it means there's some moral conflict. Is that related to the inequity around the resources provided that health center staff had available? Could you get a little bit more specific about how that might look in the health center setting?
Well, I think the article that I cited that we saw earlier this year is a good example where we have a provider who knows what the science tells us will help her patients who have COVID-19 infection. And yet in the health center setting where this individual works, and I think in many of our other health centers around the country, there wasn't as ready access to those therapeutics. So here you have this dilemma. You know what the right treatment is, and yet you also have to experience not being able to get that to the patient who is your patient. You have known this patient for, you know, in family medicine, we know them for, you know, we use the term sperm to worm, right? We know them their whole life, and we have a relationship with them. And we feel like we're breaching our responsibility in our relationship when we know what the best treatment is, and yet we're not able to deliver on that for them.
And health center leaders, not just providers, can experience the moral injury too. If they've been trying to get, you know, adequate supplies and they're always last in line, or, you know, issues like that, there can be issues within the health center. Let's say a board of directors says most mask mandates are now by law in health centers, but before they were, let's say a board of directors said we don't want to do the mask thing for everybody, and let's say the CEO and the rest of the staff wanted to. So there can be different levels of that all down the line from the White House and Congress, you know, all the way down to the local level.
Right. And along the different stages of the pandemic, I imagine that there was the concept of moral injury applied when the vaccines were first rolled out and the access to them was obviously very inequitable until health centers began to get direct supply for their patients and communities.
And I think it also can sometimes be hard, even in the scenario where you do have access, where here's a patient who you've had a long-standing relationship with, who, you've been able to work together on things like diabetes and hypertension, and you know that because of their age and other illnesses, they're at higher risk, and yet they're not wanting to accept the vaccine and needing to work really hard because you want to maintain that trusting relationship. And yet you know, based on the evidence, that their refusal at this point in time places them at a risk. And that's very hard when you've been the provider and you have a relationship with them and you want to be there for them, but the decisions that they're making have far-reaching impact, not just for themselves as individuals, but for their family and community as well.
Yeah, and we might make a distinction there between the stress, which is an added stress of being a healthcare provider in that scenario, and whether that's moral injury. I've, been a pediatrician, and I've had so many parents not want to get their children immunized, even when there is a measles epidemic or a pertussis outbreak. And we have long dealt with that and have borne the consequences of people deciding that's an individual choice. But moral injury is when our leadership makes us act in ways that are not consistent with our profession. And so when the leadership denies us either the ability to practice good quality care or denies the very science around our care, that's where we get into that moral injury.
Are the emotional challenges, the stress, the overwork leading staff at health centers to quit at the same rate? Maybe not the same rate, but is it leading health center staff to quit the way it is across the healthcare field in general? What do we know about that right now?
Alex, that's for health centers. I think that's a really important question to ask. NAC, our policy team, just completed a workforce survey amongst health centers, and the findings from that, sometimes you don't want to be like everybody else, but unfortunately, in this case, we are. And what they found was that probably close to 20% of health centers who responded were reporting losing 25% or more in attrition. This was highest amongst the nurses. And your question about the reasons, sometimes this is more dependent upon like how you ask the survey. So, or what the questions are in the survey. And the reasons that were actually coming up in the way this survey was administered really made it so that financial opportunities at larger healthcare institutions was the number one. But second, cited were stressors from the ongoing pandemic impacting staff well-being. So, yes, I think that's my long-winded way of saying, yeah, unfortunately, we are experiencing that, and this is probably one situation where I wish we weren't like everybody else.
Well, let's shift from talking about the problem to talking about some of the ways staff individually and health centers as organizations and health center leadership can support the mental and emotional health of their staff. What are some of the ways that you've heard about that you're recommending in your work?
So the timing of your question is actually a good one because we just actually asked that question of some of the people who are our key informants, our committee members, particularly for the clinical affairs division. And I guess what I would say first is that for me, if you were to say, you know, sort of what are the important things that I would like to see happen, I think one is it's so important that health center leaders recognize what's going on and also recognize that anything you do to try to help the situation requires both time, support, and space for healing. And, you know, a lot of this work in this area of moral distress and moral injury, again, from Dr. Shade, supports this approach that, you know, he said things like healing is done by survivors, not to survivors, and that the first steps are actually to be in a safe environment and also take care of themselves. Self-care is really important, but that the work really also relies on being able at some point to what he calls construct a personal narrative, and that you're able to share this narrative with what he calls a trustworthy community. And that's, again, where psychological safety is really key. So you ask for, you know, what are some of our health centers doing? And a couple of examples came back were really heartening to me, that there are a couple health centers where their leadership has actually recognized and carved out time for staff to meet both as provider groups or in smaller groups to talk about subjects where we may not necessarily use the terms that they would use, but nonetheless, they have carved out space and time to talk about resiliency and burnout. And I think those are really important examples to pay attention to and follow. I also think that there's things that you can do on a smaller scale. We had a presentation at our Policy and Issues Forum last week with the behavioral health leader from Cherokee Health, who had us, I was, rolling in the aisles, of course, virtually in my own home, of some of the fun activities that they did at their health center. And they had pictures to prove it. And I think recognizing that there's actually some skills that we have when we are in community with our humor and our ways to bring joy into our lives that we know very well how to do, that's really important. I think some of the other things that I'm so impressed that our health center colleagues have, even with all of the, you know, quick pivots we've had to do to virtual care and standing up testing and vaccinations, you know, health centers continue to work on improving their workflows. So doing things like looking at things that help with documentation, like using scribes, or I think one health center even took on a new EHR system, which I say, wow to that. But knowing the system they took on, I can see why they would do it. And even during the pandemic, organizations are undertaking system-wide anti-racism training, conducting listening sessions that are organization-wide, and learning new skills like the language of caring. So I think, you know, our health center teams and leadership are on a road that I think will definitely help with what our staff needs during this time, but we just need to do it more. And we probably need to do it for longer than we anticipated, just like this pandemic has gone on.
Jenny, is there anything you'd like to add?
Sure. I thought of three two-word phrases that come to mind with this. And the first is core to our whole identification as community health centers. So it's community development. But not in the sense of what we typically do, which is see the health center as a forum for community development and a mechanism for it, but the community development of our staff, of our workforce. And the word community is really critical because, as we all know, we've been very separated in the pandemic, and that has led to a lot of the stress. So, and as Grace mentioned, even doing things virtually, we can foster community. So fostering the development of community in new ways while we're in this time and beyond is an opportunity to address some of these issues. The other two-word thing that comes to mind for me is naming, lament. And lament is an ancient process of healing, of the first stage of healing. And healing doesn't happen well unless you state what it is wrong. And we see that with work around anti-racism efforts. We also can see that around work with workforce injury, whatever name you want to call it, but being able to actually state what it is that's the problem. And for me, that's why I don't like burnout, because that's not the right name for me. So allowing everyone to name what's the right name in community together is important, and so that everyone affected feels like their voice was heard and they were understood and they can go forward into a healing plan because they've been part of the fabric of naming it. And the third two words are planned pauses. And this is something Atul Gawande has been big on in his writing, and other people have been big on in this time of the pandemic. And that's building in times of chaos and uncertainty and constant unpredictability is building in planned pauses in the workday and the work week and the month, where everybody has a chance to sort of rest and recenter and look and see whether where they're going is still the direction that they want to be going in. And are there efforts that they're spending energy on yielding what they hope they'll yield? So having some thoughtful planned pauses, both for restoration and also for evaluation.
That sort of leads me to my related question to that, which is, are you hearing about any policy changes that health centers are putting in place to account for staff's need to take pauses or recharge, connect, anything from compensation to leave policies to other policies?
There's lots of policies around hybrid workforce right now, a lot. Of course, if you're doing touch the person care, it's harder to make that happen. But even so, around telehealth, there's been some pretty, I think, creative responses to it, where a provider might have one full day of telehealth and one full day of in-person, and they can take that telehealth from home if they want to. The same for scheduling some of their other, even their in-person kind of work, not just providers, but, you know, nurses and other staff. Again, I think equity needs to be looked at, because we can overlook people who don't have a lot of flexibility. And so one policy might help a narrow group of the folks who work there, but it may actually make things worse with some animosity among those who can't take advantage of that. And there was a really, really good article in The Atlantic either today or yesterday on that, on the 5-day work week and where it's going. But I know health centers have done policies around that, and also around what constitutes full time. Some of that is changing. Some health centers that were adamant that everybody had to be full-time are reconsidering that. And some of it's just basic need. They can't find people to work full-time. And then the expansion of mental health benefits is another policy that's been out there. Those are just a few, I know. Oh, and I've heard of some around expanding daycare support, childcare as a policy. I don't know. Grace, what have you heard?
Alex, I think that's a great question. Again, you know, sort of giving a shout out to the health center leaders who have recognized that the way they budget the time and space to have these activities is something that is a vehicle already available to them, right? You have to have a budget, and you should budget for what you feel is important for your staff. Some of the things we also heard in the feedback are really looking to the feedback they get from employees through their staff surveys, and looking at what is going on with maybe the existing committees they might have for employee health and well-being and wellness. I also think, you know, it doesn't always take a policy. Some of it is you already have the policy, but it's how you execute it that can make a difference. And so simple things like in your meetings, you know, are you taking the opportunity to check in with people? And some organizations told us that in their staff meetings, you know, they've started to include things that I think, you know, might be familiar to us at NAC already, like mission moments, and introducing some opportunities where the staff in the community of the health center can get the time and space to work on self-care. So having time for yoga or meditation and gratitude exercises within the staff meeting itself. And I think I agree with Jenny that structurally you do need to look at things like, what are your benefits? What are your salaries? What are the schedules that are available to all staff that are supportive of the healing and recovery that's going to be really important for a long time while we're still in the pandemic?
So given the disproportionate impact of the pandemic on communities of color, the systemic racism in this country, and the media reports of racism against Asian American communities, are you hearing about, or do you have any recommendations for supporting the specific mental and emotional health needs of health center staff of color? Is there, you know, anything specific where staff are getting together and focusing on issues specific to what they've been experiencing?
So as I, you know, mentioned in some of the feedback we got from our, you know, sort of key informants on our committees and task force, yes, you know, there's organization-wide anti-racism training going on, which I think in the time of a pandemic is a very necessary but admirable undertaking with everything else that's on our plates. Honestly, Alex, the answer to your question, I think, could take me hours. So I'm going to use somebody else's words, because it'll take a long time for me to say what's in my heart on this. But I take, I like what Archbishop Michael Curry has said. And he has sort of three pieces of advice. And he says, you stand up, you speak up, and you show up. And so I think that's for all of us. And then I do have a personal note, that is that for my colleagues working in community health centers, who, like myself, are people of color, you know, we are a community, and we are all here for each other. And you all have great minds and wonderful hearts. And what you feel and say and do in this regard is truth.
Thank you. Is there anything else that either of you would like to say in closing? And I also want to note that the resources, any resources mentioned, we'll put on the episode page on the NAC website that were mentioned in this episode. Any closing thoughts?
Well, I have to say one thing that drew me to community health centers and has kept me there, other than the mission, which is huge, is that I was working typically as a minority white person in wherever I worked. So I was surrounded by a diverse group of people, and the leaders of the community health center reflected their community in the ones that I worked in. I know that's not always the case, but I've done several hundred operational site visits, and that's typically been the case. So the board of directors typically looks like the health center patients. There's with unsheltered patients, that's less true, but even then they have representatives on the board. And many, many of the staff have come from the community and look like the community, including the doctors. And that has always been a really powerful thing in my own humanity. And I wish health centers would be able to do some sort of showcase for the rest of the U.S. around justice and equity and diversity, because many of them have done really well.
Thank NAC for the opportunity to spend some time with you and Jenny to talk about these important topics, and to let you know that these are things that within the Community Affairs Division we'll be working on, and to stay tuned for some more learning opportunities on this really important topic.
That's what I was just going to thank both of you for the time and attention that you have created so that NAC can help host these conversations, and you've held them in lots of different formats, from blogs to conference presentations. I know the forthcoming clinical newsletter is going to be focused on some of this. So I appreciate your time, and I know that this is ongoing work for you. So we really
ongoing for all of us. Yep.
Ongoing for all of us.
Yeah. And thank you to whoever's listening who's working in a health center. You still are our heroes.
This podcast was produced by HeartCast Media.